IMRO's 2023 Best Local or Regional News Programme, The Voice of the Northwest, the 9 till noon show with Greg Hughes.
Thanks again to Paddy, Pat and Richard for their contributions over the last hour. And we appreciate it, and we appreciate you messaging, calling, texting in. And some of your comments are as follows. When I was on holiday in America in 1988, we went to Mexico on a day trip. On the way back, we were checked by customs. They pulled in myself and my wife and asked why we were there, etc. I had to prove that I was on holiday in America. Thank God that my passport was stamped. Why does Ireland not have the same approach? I suppose we board buses and stuff. I'm not sure if that would be the same thing, checking people's identifications. But in certain states of America too, you'll get customs checks within the state, and you have to prove you're a US citizen. Asylum seekers come in their thousands every day to Ireland. We need a plan like Rwanda, which the UK have. Hi, Greg. Israel was created by a little Jewish Ulster. To be a little Jewish Ulster among the Arab world, according to the biography of the first British High Commissioner for Palestine. The Jews were not the only people to experience genocide. There were 12 million people killed in the concentration camps. There's no word of the other 6 million who were murdered, who were not Jews, including Gypsies, Poles and others. There's no mention of the German genocide in Africa in the early 1900s. This is all about weaponizing the Holocaust and anti-Semitism to benefit one particular group power-wise, so they can wage genocide against the Palestinians. A caller says it's tough on musical acts to be pressured to abandon a breakthrough musical event like the Eurovision. How about the EBU banning Israel and let the rest get on with it? They're not going to do that, but yeah, they don't want to. Well, they did make them change the words of their song, actually. Why do your guests, anti-Semites disguised as outraged humanitarians, never call for the release of the hostages, many of whom are also children? Tell the person screeching hate Israelis not run by Zionists. Of course, there are Zionists in the country, the same as there are people in this country that hate Protestants and want a Catholic-only Ireland. If your guests directed their anger towards what's going on in this bloody country, they might get some respect. That woman you have on must have been biting her tongue to avoid denying the Holocaust. Well, I don't think you could accuse Pat of that. But I do actually take your point in that I think the October 7th attacks were mentioned and always should be mentioned, and also should be always roundly condemned. And as part of that, the ongoing, whether people are women, children or men for that matter, the ongoing holding of hostages too is something that has to end. There has to be an agreement where those hostages are released and released safely, but also too that somewhat indiscriminate bombing that's killing tens of thousands of children and women and men needs to stop as well. But yes, of course, we should never omit what's happening to those people who are hostages as well, going through an awful nightmare. A caller believes Israel should be banned from the Eurovision and all sporting events in a similar way to how Russia was ostracised. Israel's genocide in Gaza is far worse than the actions of Russia, yet none of the world leaders and none of the major organisations are taking appropriate action to force Israel to cease its industrial-scale murder of civilians. Dual standard shows the utter hypocrisy and schizophrenia of the modern world. And add to that, though, do we need to start taking a stance then too against the likes of Saudi Arabia and others who are also responsible for atrocities? Because, you know, there's not a hierarchy, is there, of human rights violations. Of course there is, in terms of, you know, what's happening in Palestine is not on a par to necessarily something happening somewhere else, but our levels of outrage, okay? So if we deem a country to be acting outside of what deemed to be acceptable, we can't cherry pick that either, do we? So we would have to start saying, right, you can't wash your reputation through golf and through snooker and through boxing or through soccer either, can you? Look at the World Cup. Everyone's sitting there taking a high moral ground, sitting at the World Cup in Qatar, in stadiums built on the backs of dead migrant workers, many of them trafficked. They were still over there. They were still taking the money and trying to make some political stance from within the stadium. You know, that's hypocrisy to an extent as well. And I think if we start taking actions like this, do we not then need to say, right, well, that's our moral compass and we have to follow through? Hi, Greg. Why is Israel included in any Eurovision context when it is part of Africa? Where is the consistency when we exclude Algeria, Morocco, etc.? I don't know what the welcoming criteria is. Australia's in there, other side of the world. Russia has been in there as well. I don't know. I don't know who Richard is, but I guess he's a Fine Gael supporter. And if he is, what's wrong with that? The state of Israel did not disappear so long as people like Richard are supporting the killing of children and bombing of hospitals and schools. He condemned that outright. So, you know, I mean, that's the only thing I can say. Richard condemned those actions. Pat is the only one talking sense on the panel, and she believes elsewhere there was Israeli apologists for what they're doing. I'm not sure that's fully fair either. Hamas could try releasing the hostages and see if that works. There was no analogues action with, for example, apartheid. I think that I can appreciate boycotts in the instance of Gaza as something has to be done. The murders of women and children, unacceptable, and we should do something to show Israel that we do not condone this. I don't think that Israel care at all, because no matter what, if other countries are protesting against it, they should think twice about what they're doing. And there's other things coming in on different subjects as well. I want to bring Seamus Gunn into the conversation, or into that item. We'll not talk about that. But we have a lot of requests, so I want to get through to them, if that's okay. A wonderful mum and granny, Rosemary Patton in Trimmer Letterkenny. She's 80 today. Hope you have a great day. Love, Charlie, Catherine, Dion, Jake and Millie. A big happy birthday to you, Granny Rosemary. Happy 50th birthday to all the staff at Highland Radio from O'Donnell Family Ballybuffet. Are we 50? Is that right? I don't know. Is that bakery? What's that mean? Well, that was ages ago. I'm pushing 51 now. But if it is, thank you. Play a request for Amy Shields in Tamney on her 12th birthday today from Daddy and Mammy. Happy birthday, Amy. A big hello to Clodagh Rose McConnellogue, making her first communion in Derry today, from Auntie Lily and all your family in Letterkenny. Have a lovely day, Clodagh. It is going to be a very special day for you, and it's going to be a very special day in nice weather. Another one for Clodagh Rose McConnellogue, this time coming in from, actually it's the same request, from Aunt Lily and all the family in Letterkenny. Keep your requests coming in. More than happy to read those as they come in as well, by the way. Okay, Seamus Gunn of McLaughlin Gunn and Company, Remelton and Letterkenny is with us again for our monthly chat. Good morning to you, Seamus. How are you keeping?
Morning, Greg. How are you?
I'm doing good, actually. Listen, before we get into listeners' questions, and they're coming in all the while, there's a huge trial ongoing in America. A lot of people are taking an interest in it in any case, but also it, as it centres around Donald Trump, it is probable, if not likely or whatever, I think they're both the same thing really, effectively, that he could be once again the president of the United States. And that has a ripple effect and ramifications right across the world. Make no mistake about that, be it in terms of, you know, wars, in terms of finances, in terms of everything really effectively. So he's currently in Manhattan taking part in a criminal trial. It's heading into its, it's well into its second week, and it follows a raucous testimony about his increasingly unhinged underling and tawdry business of celebrity sex scandals. So shall I read what he's charged with, or are you going to explain what he's charged with, Seamus?
Well, yeah, it's been out there for long enough. Greg, he's battling on all fronts, and he's certainly well up for it. He's using it to its max for his own promotion, whether or not that's going to pay dividends when it comes down to the 5th of November. We can only wait and see, but he certainly has a strategy. The present case, of course, there's something like 34 criminal counts. This, to be fair to him, and we try to be, would not be the most serious. The conspiracy, the federal charges that are presently still awaiting to be heard and will be likely to be panned out beyond the 6th of November in Georgia and Washington and with regard to the election and interfering with it thereafter are much more serious as with regard to penalties in that the term of imprisonment, for example, could be 12 years plus in any of those. And then he has the concealment of the documents way down in Mar-a-Lago or whatever. So they're all still in the wings, as it were. And this is the hush, well, they call it the hush money case that's running now. And he's running into all sorts of, pardon the pun, stormy water with regard to the judge.
I'm not going to. I'm sorry.
In the week,
I'm sorry. I know it's often rhetorical, but I'm not pardoning that pun.
As he has a gag order. Against him already. On Tuesday, I think there was something around 4,000 was imposed in relation to comments that he has been making with regard to, I think it's the judges, the one of the judges, members of their family, being working, having worked for the Democrats. So he's really pushing out this political point the whole time. The case centres around money being given by his then attorney, and who would like to be his attorney, because there's so many of them. There's another one in Arizona, I think, indicted during the week with Rudy Giuliani in with regard to the election. Anyway, Michael Cohen, who was his then attorney, allegedly paid off Stormy Daniels, Stephanie Clifford, being her real name, to suppress this story coming into the public domain before the 2016 election. Alleged, he paid her $130K or something in dollars, and then the money was repaid to him over a number of installments of $35K or so thereabouts each. And that was put through, I think must be nearly 12 of those. That was then put through the system as legal expenses for him. So that's cooking the books to some degree, you might say. But that's what's before the court.
But Seamus,
at the moment.
An awful lot of this and all about this is about timing, really, isn't it? Because, you know, whether this is a disadvantage or advantage for him being seen to be, you know, a victim of the system because he's so powerful, the truth is if this can sort of be rolled out post-election and he becomes the president, then it really all of it, presumably, goes away.
Well, yeah, you could be. You'll be into a very interesting next chapter. I mean, I haven't really had any deep dive into this, but there will be a question then: can a president, if he is successful, pardon himself? Because that's what you're. That's what you think of it. That's probably what you're going to be looking at down the road if he gets that far, and he could very well do between the way the polls are at the minute and the way that they're so finely balanced, and whether or not this type of airing, this type of publicity is going to harm that middle ground or not, which is what we've said before, is how this election looks like it's going to be played out in the few swing states, and whether he's actually going to be able to sway that middle ground towards him to make the difference of the couple of percent. Like, in for example, I think in one of the states the last time, there's less than 1% between them. Mm-hmm. And there's law going on in a number of those states like Arizona, Georgia, and that at the minute. So will that influence people against Donald Trump, or will it, you know, harden them and say towards them? Like that's really the imponderable here, and that's what's so fascinating about it. But going down the road, if he is successful, then he takes a long look and says, well, I think you're probably right. These things will go off. Could go off into the ether. They couldn't be coming to try it anyway during his term. They'd have to be kicked out beyond that. Then there are going to be questions about the statute of limitation, prejudice, and all the passage of time. So yes, but if he's not successful, let's flip the coin over and see where we are then. If that's the case, he could be in some serious jeopardy. And there's one other little point I think that's just of interest, maybe just to mention it in passing. This is a major distraction for him personally. He's sitting there gagged under threat of further gagging orders. On a daily basis, he has to turn up at the trial. Rightly so. They're talking about another 6 weeks in. So he's not out there campaigning the way he would prefer to be. It's not presidential. Mm. Let's put it to you like that.
But to his fans...
His present demeanour in the court.
Yeah,
but
of
he's
course.
Doing... doing his best to project himself out beyond that. This is politically driven, and it's all trumped up by the Democrats, and that's nothing more, nothing less than that. Whether people buy into that or not, we'd wait and see. But the point is this, though, with all this distraction, the amount of money, and this really hasn't been highlighted at all, it's maybe only a thought of my own, but the amount of money it has to be taken to service these defences and these lawyers across America must be staggering. And I would believe that would be eaten into his war chest regarding his funding. And this will take millions, literally millions, to be defending all these different actions on all fronts. So that could have a negative effect in a very practical way, because the millions might be there to put up as you know as big an advertising type campaign, and the funding that he would usually have in that.
Yeah. Like
in one case alone, is that the post a bond or something for over $250 million with regard to a civil claim that was the fraud claim, and he was ordered to pay. I think that went wrong on him about 400 or 450 million. So these are all issues, but that could have a really big effect, because That's a serious trade on funds.
But I think his greatest advantage, before we move back to questions, is his opponent. Like, there's a population of 333 odd million in the United States, and it's come. I think it's really quite remarkable that it's come down to these two guys, because Mr. Biden, and I'm a great respecter of older people, and he's got a long, healthy, active life ahead of him, I hope, and I'm sure. But he is very much inclined not to make any sense when he's speaking at times. And Donald Trump can also be
slightly
guilty.
Slightly unfair. I think that could apply to both maybe at times.
Well, no, yes, that's exactly what I was just about to say. And I say, I don't. This is not in any way ageist, and I don't want to come across like that. But even it's got to the point where if you were trying to cut an audio clip from Joe Biden to run alongside a script, at times you would actually struggle. You know what he's saying, but at times you might be struggle for it to be coherent to the point that he was trying to make. Donald Trump is also guilty of that if you see some of his live speeches. And then you've got everything else that's going on around him as well. And as I say, I've avoided saying that out loud for fear of it being seen as ageist. And I think my record stands on this show as an advocate for older people that that's not the case. But I just think that it is a concern that it has come down to these two guys who have tons, I'm sure, to add to life. But I think just with the role that they're being asked to fulfill if elected, they don't come across as capable to me, I'm sorry to say.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, that would find an awful lot of support being objective about it. What is surprising, though, is with all their influence and the Republicans and the Democrats and their histories, that they haven't been bringing along some new blood.
Yeah, exactly.
That in between, that they're saying that the writing is on the wall to anybody that's logical and objective and reading the situation. Now, just in the same context of, as your point, it strikes me that back when Joe Biden was elected, and like he's been in several different regimes, and he's vice president, etc. So, but when he was elected, it was thought then that his vice president, Kamala Harris, was going to come on board, be much more vocal, and be seen in the public eye as being the natural successor. Now that hasn't happened. I'm intrigued to know, and nobody has ever commented as to why it hasn't happened, because I thought at one stage that Joe Biden mightn't even go the full term, that he would stand down and that she would finish off maybe as the president and be the president-elect for this time around.
I just get a sense in relation to that. This is a bit of a deep question. I think that politically things have changed an awful lot in the last 3 or 4 years, and maybe advances in terms of the acceptance of a black female president. It might have seemed like a good idea 2 years in advance of the last election. I'm not sure it's the same now. We've had an awful lot of people of colour and of different backgrounds that have been the leaders of the country, and one by one they're somewhat falling away. And also, too, if you look at social media, there's just a change in rhetoric and language and a hardening of views in some ways. And I just wonder if that was part of it, that they don't believe with the way the world seems to be changing, and it's not something I'm terribly comfortable with, is if that may be a female person of colour as US president couldn't be sold mid-Biden term.
Yeah, you can certainly put that. You can put that out there. Do I concur with that? Well, just from observations of her and her competence, I would like to think that it hasn't changed to that degree. But if it had, and we're not in the US, but one that are there with their finger on the pulse in the Democratic Party, if that is the situation, then you are duly obliged to be looking elsewhere. But, you know, to to be on the pulse and to be working right while they're grooming or bringing along another suitable and appropriate candidate. But I did think that she certainly had the potential.
It looked
to
like
step
the
up.
Fix was in. But I'm going to flip it again to you.
On the Republican side, I can't name anybody, I'm sorry to say. It's just been dominated by one guy who has an ego and a thirst for power. And that is going to be very difficult to quench.
But the thing
and
is
anybody,
I,
and anybody that puts their head above the parapet,
well, that's it.
On this occasion there was one, are quickly set aside, and it moves on as a one-man band.
Yeah.
And that could be where it falls down.
Of course, because I think Trump is so powerful that there are three or four candidates, if he didn't exist, that would be vying in a very competitive race and probably do very well for his party. But given his popularity, both in politics and outside politics, I think he was able to swap people away like no one else. I don't think there's anyone else has in the past or perhaps good into the future. Seamus Gunn staying with us because we're going to go to your questions next. It's always fascinating to have Seamus on the show to have a run through some of the big legal stories locally, nationally and around the world, but also as an opportunity now to get to some of your questions, Seamus. So a listener says, my father passed away. I sent away to a hospital three times and requested my father's files under Freedom of Information. I've been refused access to his files. How do I go about trying to get my hands on them? I've appealed it twice too. Would a solicitor have a role to play in this?
Well, the answer to the last part is probably first, Greg, yes, maybe. But first, I think that before you would have such a role, one of the requirements that we would always advise people to get at the outset, if you're going to have a look at something with a view to potential negligence action. Well, in that case, they have to have the records. Unfortunately, the caller seems to have been frustrated. Now, what isn't clear here, I think, and this is relevant, they don't say why they were refused. That is pretty critical because there could be very bona fide reasons for that. They do say that it was their father that passed away. It happened to indicate like who the next of kin is. They can make a member of the next of kin can make an application to obtain the records. The legal personal representative, if the individual made a will, the executor could make an application. If there was a spouse, that would be the first person in line. If your partner, they could also make the application. They haven't come back to give any indication as to why they have been refused. They have appealed it. There is a procedure for, first of all, it'd be an internal appeal, totally objective. And then if they're still happening, they're asking where to go next, then in that case, you can appeal again to the Information Commissioner under the FOI, Freedom of Information Act, and again, on a point of law, to the High Court, and that's what he would
never
really,
really thought.
They would need legal representation.
Yeah. I've but never really thought about this, Seamus.
Where they're at with regard to the complaint legally, they'll need the records.
I've never really thought about this, but if I would like my medical records to die with me, to be honest with you. I don't like the idea, and I didn't think it was possible that. You know, I have nothing to hide, right? But if I made decisions in life to keep private to me, I would like that to be respected after I pass away, to be honest with you. I would like maybe if there was reasons why I didn't want to tell my children something, and whatever it might be. I can't think of examples, okay? But I don't want people going through my medical records after I pass away. So,
Well, how does that fit in? In that case, that's a very interesting point, because you're really hitting on the nerve of this, that do the actual records die with you or not? This question is phrased in such a way that there would seem an inference that there's some disquiet about the manner in which this person passed away.
Yeah.
I think that's obvious. So as a next of kin, you want to know what happened. That's perfectly understandable and human. On the other hand, the deceased may have within their records matters that are totally private. that they don't want and mightn't be relevant at all to the case in point as to cause of death or whether there may be potentially some medical misadventure in the manner of which they were cared for. So that's a net point. But if one is seeking all medical record, you could, though, as the individual, leave a direction, like a healthcare direction, that they are not to be accessed. Mm. And this is where we go back to, again, the very point about making one's arrangements and in advance, mm-hmm. Leaving your situation, that it does this amount dies with me. But in the event that there is any issue about my death or my treatment or that, then they're certainly entitled that you would like that your family or your next of kin, your executor, should be able to access those records, but put an embargo and a restriction on it to that effect. Now, will that be acknowledged and upheld? And that's another tricky point. To do that, you might have to leave a stipulation within the records itself that these are not to be disclosed. And then you come to another one, that if that's the situation, the keeper of the records, the HSE, would have to maybe try to defend that view. And that could end up in the High Court as well with regard to some type of discovery of the records. And if that was the situation, it would be only, in my opinion, those records that were relevant to investigation of the care of the individual that may or may not have been a feature or a factor.
And an institute
in their cause.
And an institution is not going to work with you on that. I think they'd have to be very careful as to what they're actually asking about.
Yes.
And what their actual request is. So if you look for a blanket furnishing of someone's medical records, they're not going to come back to you and say, we can't give you more, but we can give you... You have to make sure that you're asking a specific question so you know the specific refusal.
And detail loads. But there is, as I said, just at the outset, there is an appeal. There's an appeal then to the Information Commissioner. But I'm intrigued to know as to why they have been declined in the first instance. And I think there's more in there than that. Mm. So, there could be a member of the family there could be a spouse, for example, who would be next in line. There could actually be an executor appointed under a will who would be the person entitled to make the application.
Yeah. Okay.
So those things should be teased out first. But before you consider anything going down the misadventure route or any potential medical negligence, you're certainly going to need the records. The relevant, pertinent records only.
Yeah, and don't give the institution an opportunity to blanket refuse in case
they will do that, and rightly so. We don't have the reasons stipulated.
Mm. And now these are, I'm going to group in a few taxation questions, and I know you've said in the past, but I know you can answer them too, so I'm going to still ask you. Can you ask Seamus, if a father was to sign over a farm of land to a son or daughter, would either party have to pay tax? And if so, how much would it be percentage-wise?
Obviously I have to qualify this. I'm not a tax consultant. I do recommend people about taxation and tax planning. It's money well spent into the future. But as lawyers, we deal with capital acquisitions tax and inheritance and estates basically all the time. With capital acquisitions tax, just briefly, there's two sides to it. One is inheritance and one is gifts. They're both the same as far as the liability is concerned. And each individual is entitled to what is a threshold. If you're a son or daughter, your threshold in money terms stands currently at $335,000. If you're a nephew, niece or sibling, I think it's $32,500. And if you're a stranger, it's half that again. So that'd be $16,250. Once you go over that, you are liable to pay tax to the revenue at 33% once your threshold is used up. Now, for the purpose of the question, the individual saying about a farm, there's two points that might be relevant, might be helpful. If they are farmers, if they're going to be farmers themselves, and 80% of their assets after the inheritance are agricultural, they may qualify for what's called agricultural relief. If they've agricultural relief, happy days. That their inheritance then would be reduced down significantly, and it would only be coming in at 10% of the value. Unless you exceeded the threshold, then you wouldn't have any tax to pay. So this is why, looking forward now, if your assets are not and you can't get agricultural relief, your threshold is 300 and $35,000. You pay a tax over and above that. If you're inheriting a house, there can be certain exemptions too. If it's your own private house and you're going to live in it and you've lived in it in the past, you might be exempt. But the thresholds are there. They can be worked with, and there are certain exemptions that do apply.
This is not a question. I think it's more of a comment. If I was left $250,000 in a will, that money came from money earned. Tax was paid on it, obviously, by the relative. Why should I have to pay tax in it again? Surely double taxation has to be against the law. Challenge it if it is, but I don't think it'll succeed.
They're lucky. That's what they are. They're very lucky to be inheriting €250,000. And if it's a son or daughter, they're not above their $335,000 threshold, so they'll be taking it tax-free. So in that case, now, let's go a step further. If they're a brother or sister or nephew or niece, their threshold is drastically reduced. They're allowed $32,500 to pay 33% over and above that. So you're talking about $217,000 at 33%, 66 to 72 odd thousand there if you're, and then if you're a stranger, it's even more. But if they're a son or daughter, they're not above their threshold and they're taking it tax free. The comment about the person who's paid their taxes on, that's great. They're good, responsible citizens of the country.
Imagine getting $250,000. Oh yes. My God! Okay.
Yeah, I think you'd be just, thanking your lucky stars.
I'll tell you, I wouldn't be in on Tuesday. If I gave my children $3,000 a year for 10 years tax free, will that come off the total I can leave them when I die?
There's a small exemption relief, I believe, and that's right on the money. It's $3,000 a year that you can give. I think you can take it from anybody. Anyone can give you $3,000 a year and a small gift, and that's exempt. So once it's kept at that and sealed at that per annum, I don't believe that should be taken into account when considering the threshold thereafter, subject to correction, but that'd be my interpretation of it.
Okay, I'm going to stick on the will theme because, as you know, Seamus, we've got an awful lot of questions in relation to this area. If I'm a co-executor of a will and the other executor is not engaging with the beneficiaries, well, what can I do?
Well, in that particular case, it's to deal with an estate, you're given a responsibility if you're appointed as an executor. Generally, there is two, there could even be three, there could be four. But those that act, they haven't indicated whether this individual is going to act. That's the first port of call, to ascertain are they going to act as a co-executor. And if they are, then they have to take certain actions. They have to gather in the estate. To do that, they first have to get everything valued as at the time the person passed away, to include land and all personal estate and money, security for monies. And then they have to compile a statement of affairs and then submit the will to probate. Seems like one may be active and one is not. There is what's called, and I've said this before, an executor's year. So if it goes beyond a year, another co-executor can then take steps to, as it were, have them either removed or move ahead themselves. And they'd have to go by way of the probate court on that. But initially, the first point that has to be addressed is that party acting? Now, if they're not acting, they may very well be quite happy to renounce their executorship and just sign a form to that effect. That frees the way completely for the co-executor to get on with dealing with the estate.
Okay.
But in all these cases, you have a death. You have people wondering what's happening. The key to them is communication.
Yeah. I'm going to group
that line up. And if there's not communication, it soon deteriorates.
I'm grouping a load of questions in, maybe 10 questions here. People waiting anything from 18 months to 2 years to 3 years, in one case for 4 years, for a will to be read or to progress. You've had these questions for years, Seamus. What is the timeline? What's a reasonable amount of time to wait, etc.?
Timeline for them before they can take an action, as I just referenced, it was the executor's year. And so we're looking that we go beyond that. People are saying 2, 3, and 4 years. I think, well, to just give some idea, there can be complications. You can have assets that you're trying to track. You can have assets that may be here or maybe in other jurisdictions. So there are situations that arise. There could be title matters that could arise with property, etc., that could be all in the mix and could extend the timeline out quite a long way in relation to finalising the estate. There's no doubt about that, and that does happen. Remember, the people that are looking at it, waiting on their payment or whatever, their inheritance, remember, they're not privy to this information, all of it, and how complex or how complicated the deceased might have been in relation to their family, in relation to their financial affairs. But so the executors are charged, or the legal personal representative, with gathering all that in, and that can take a significant amount of time. It can even take a significant amount of time to deal with financial institutions and to obtain certificates as to balances as at the date of death. But we have a very efficient probate registry office here in the Circuit Court in Letterkenny. And if papers are in order and the statement of affairs are complete and the executors are happy to move on, grants of probate can be obtained in 6 to 9 months, but it's not unusual for them to go a lot longer than that.
And look at Seamus.
Collecting in the assets can go a good bit further again. So you have to look on each particular case on its merits in the particular circumstances that the executors meet when dealing with it or the personal representatives meet, and the complications that can arise therein. And in many cases, it is true, they can go on for another year.
But I mean, obviously, where things move quickly and satisfactorily to all parties, we never hear about them on this programme because people move on and get on with their life and they're happy out. Okay.
Well, that's good to hear.
Yeah, of course. Seamus Gunn of McLaughlin Gunn and Company with offices in Remelton and Letterkenny, and also an ever-present online, one of the early adapters to online, our own Seamus Gunn.
Absolutely, yeah. And we're delighted that we did take that plunge, as it were, and we're getting simpler all the time. Gunn.ie, or you want to go for the longer version, the original, DonegalsLister.ie, Greg. Thanks very
Superb.
Much.
Thank you so much, Seamus Gunn of McLaughlin Gunn and Company. Justice Marie Baker is chair of Commission Tayahan and joins us on the programme now. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg. Aren't you very lucky? You're going to get lovely weather.
It's always sunny up here in the northwest.
But it's always beautiful.
Okay. Hopefully we'll be able to have a longer conversation ahead of the upcoming local and European elections. But just an early reminder for people, we have an important opportunity to exercise our hard-won democratic right to vote in local and European elections. And here in the Northwest, in the European elections alone, there are 27 candidates. We've yet to see precisely how many will contest in Donegal for the local elections, but it'll be nigh on 60. So what should people be doing, I suppose, really, in preparation of June 7th?
The first thing, really, Greg, and I can't say this often enough, is make sure you're registered to vote. So if you go on, check the register to see whether you're actually registered to vote, because without being registered, you can't vote. You can vote without your polling card, but you can't vote if you're not registered. It's straightforward enough. There are two ways of doing it. Go on your local Donegal local authority website, or the national one is checktheregister.ie. It's very easy. What we've also been saying to people, actually, Greg, is check the register, even if you know you're on it for a long time, because there's a lot to be said for bringing the register up to date and putting on your air code, for example, or putting on your PPS number. That enables the local authorities ultimately to get the system right and to get it consistent. Because if you've been registered in two different towns, for example, that won't show up unless there's some identifying feature such as your air code or your PPS number. So go online, check the register. The other thing that's important to say to people is you don't have to be an Irish citizen to vote in these elections or to be registered to vote. If you're a European citizen, you can vote in the European elections and you can register separately for that. But if you're a person who lives, ordinarily resides in the country, so in your county, then you can register to vote in that county.
To be clear then, so if I were French and I want to vote in the European elections and I register in Donegal, it is in the Midlands Northwest constituency I would be voting, though. There's not a remote vote in that situation.
No, but in fact, France offers the opportunity of voting in the embassy or by postal vote. You can't obviously vote twice. So if you opt, if you're committed to Ireland and you live here, then you might want to elect your Irish MEPs, or you might decide you're still genuinely French, mm-hmm. And you want to just vote for the French. But some countries don't offer a facility mm-hmm. of voting in the embassy. So everybody who's a European citizen should check that. But if you're Indian and you live here and you've never taken Irish citizenship, or wherever you're from, you can still vote, provided you're ordinarily resident.
And is there a time frame as to how long you have to have been ordinarily resident?
No, actually, there isn't. And I think that's deliberate. It's because you can commit yourself to a place by just moving here and taking a rental agreement or buying a house and just committing yourself to a place. There's no fixed time. There is for other things, for revenue and things like that, but not for this.
And what is the logic of that? Because as you can imagine, given the climate we live in now, some people aren't happy about that. We'll not talk as to why they should or shouldn't be happy about that, just as if that's okay. But what would be the logic to saying, right, well, Dáil elections you can't, but local elections you can?
I haven't heard any disquiet, in fact, Greg, but just to be
stay
clear.
Stay off Twitter.
you heard it, have you? Well, I haven't heard it yet, but I'm sure it will come. I think you're right. Essentially, the purpose behind this is to give you a voice in and give you a place in the local system. I just heard the ad there for don't burn down the hedgerows in this month. Local authorities deal with planning, housing, roads, parks, libraries, all the local services. If you live in the local area, you use them. If you use them, you want a voice, your voice to be heard and how the money is distributed and how the services are operated. Okay. So that's the logic. The logic in only allowing Irish citizens vote in referendums is that the Constitution governs the rights of citizens mostly. The logic of the European election and that constituency and that electorate is, well, you are European citizens voting for your European Parliament. But local elections are different. And if you like, local elections are democracy on the ground. You know, they are the day-to-day things that okay. people avail of and the day-to-day things people want a choice over.
So check the register in the first instance, check your entitlement to vote and make sure you're registered in the place that you're going to be voting and all that stuff.
Yes, okay. At the 20th of May is the cutoff date.
Right, okay. But hopefully you'll spare us a little bit longer in the run-up.
I certainly will, yes.
I know there's a lot of demands on you.
As the debate heats up, it might be useful to discuss what local authorities can do.
I agree with you. Justice Marie Baker, thank you so much. She's chair of On Commission. Tayahan, back with more after we take a break.